often tell me that it's nice just to sit back and look at stuff that you already know. So I'm going to do that. So I'm going to start off talking about classical information and Shannon's information. And does that look all right on the screen? Yeah. Okay. So Shannon, excuse me, I think I've got a bit of a cold today. Shannon talks about a communication setup, and the idea is that you've got an information source and a channel, which might be noisy, and a receiver. And the source is producing messages in the form of sequences of symbols from some alphabet. And these are thought of as the values of independent, this is important, the values of independent and identically distributed random variables. So you could think of this source as just producing strings of zeros and ones. That would be from an alphabet of two symbols, but there could be more symbols. So the fundamental question is, how do you quantify the minimal resources required to store the messages produced by the source so that you can communicate via this channel? And the source coding theorem, or also called the noiseless channel coding theorem, answers that question. So to take a source that produces long sequences of messages from a finite alphabet, and again, we just do focus, you can think of this as 0 and 1, so that's what the A's are, but they could be. And they've got probabilities. Each symbol produces a certain probability. These are thought of as independent identity distributed random variables. And a typical sequence of length n then is going to contain close to n times pi symbols ai, because each symbol comes with a property of pi. So if you have a long sequence of n symbols, then ai is going to show up with a fraction of pi times, so it's that many times. And so the probability of a sufficiently long sequence of x's, I mean, these are just the slots, so to speak, for the zeros and ones, are going to be the probability that you get the first symbol times the probability you get the second symbol. So the probability of the first slot, second slot, and so on. And seeing that the symbol ai will show up pi times, pi n times in a sequence of n, that means that you'll get the probability that many times for probability 1. And so this will be approximately this sequence of probabilities. I mean, obviously, the longer it gets, the more it will approximate that probability. I just repeated that line over here. Taking the log of both sides to the base 2, you get the Shannon entropy pops up. You get n times pi log pi. This is n times some number, which is defined as the Shannon entropy minus pi log pi. So that's just a quick and easy way of seeing how the Shannon entropy shows up. It's going to be minus one-nth of log pi, if you like. Put it that way. I'll just look at my screen. So I'm going to go fairly quickly until we come to something interesting. So we can think of information in Shannon's sense in a couple of ways. We can take minus log pi, which is a decreasing function of pi with a minimum value of 0 when pi is 1, for some I, since all the others would be 0, as a measure of information associated with identifying one of the symbols produced by the information source. And then the Shannon entropy would just be the average information gain, because you're averaging up a lot of pi. Or you can think of it as the expectation value of the information gain, or as a measure of the amount of uncertainty about x before we ascertain its value. There's another way of thinking about it in terms of compression, which I think is actually more fundamental, and that's what we're going to get to in a second. Okay, so since that probability can be expressed as 2 to the minus n hx, just straightforwardly from where it comes from, this probability, wherever I could
where am I? Yeah, because of this relationship there, the probability, we're taking, remember, the log to the base 2, so the probability of the sequence is 2 to the minus NA times the Shannon entropy for sufficiently long sequences. It follows that there are at most 2 to the NHX typical sequences. Let me just make it pretty precise about what this is. I mean, you could have an untypical, a typical sequence. Let's say that it's zeros and ones, and zero is produced with probability a quarter, and one produced with probability 3/4. Then a typical sequence is a sequence where you actually have 1/4 zeros and 3/4 ones in some distribution. An atypical sequence would be all zeros. The probability of a typical sequence that we've seen is related to the Shannon entropy, and so each typical sequence has the same probability, and clearly there are at most 2 NHX typical sequences, because the probability of all the typical sequences is certainly less than 1. So you can have at most that many sequences. It would be that many sequences if the probability was 1. So it's at most that many sequences. So, and this is the punchline, each typical N sequence then could be encoded as a distinct binary number of that many binary digits before being sent through the channel, where the original sequence could then be reconstructed by inverting the map. And that would fail with low probability only for the atypical sequences, which you could encode just as a string of zeros. So that really is just about the idea behind the compression.
Sorry,
yeah.
Can you go back to the first interpretation?
The average information gain.
Right. Okay. So what was the thing that you defined as somehow gain? You said it's a sum,
it's average. Oh, wait a minute, I'm not sure what the question is. I mean, Shannon is trying to come up with a number which will characterize an information source. Okay. So you've got a source which is producing, say, zeros and ones with certain probabilities, and the idea is to try and capture something about that source, which is going to be associated with quantifying the minimal resources required to transfer what he calls the information that goes from that source to the receiver. So the game, so to speak, is you're producing sequences of symbols, zeros and ones, and you want to know, I'm going to produce sequences of zeros and ones, and I want to send something to the receiver in such a way that the receiver will be able to reconstruct these sequences that I'm actually producing. And of course, you could just send the sequences themselves, but could you do it in some cheaper way, so to speak? And so the relevant measure, so to speak, of the minimal resources is being constructed in this way in terms of this Shannon entropy. So you can think of Shannon entropy in various ways as it's just related to the problem of distribution. So if you want to say, look, you're producing sequences of zeros and ones, and I get a particular zero and one, and then I have to identify it as 0 or 1. Now, my guess beforehand might have been that there was a certain probability of getting a 0 or 1. When I actually identify it as a 0 or 1, or a sequence of zeros or ones, then I've gained some information about what you're actually producing. And the idea is that you can think of the Shannon entropy as the average information gained by identifying a particular sequence produced by the source. I actually think that it makes more sense to think of it as, in terms of Shannon's theorem, which has to do with proof of what the minimum resources required are, what the minimum resources are to send such messages, and then that's associated with the notion of compression. And the reason I say that is, so that's going to come up in a second. The reason I say that is because in the case of quantum information, where the encoding is going to be done not in terms of a sequence of distinguishable symbols like zeros and ones, these, but in terms of quantum states, and you can't think of the analog of the Shannon entropy, which is the von Neumann entropy, as the average information gain when you've identified the state, because you generally can't identify the state if the sequence of states are not orthogonal. But you can think of it in terms of compression. And so it seems to me that the right way to think of what Shannon, the right way to think of Shannon's theory of information is that he identified a certain quantity associated with a probability distribution, because the source is just a probability distribution. Where some assumptions are made about independence and so on. But it's a source of probabilities. And some aspect of that source, that is to say the probability distribution, can be compressed. And that seems to me to be the crucial notion, compressed in the sense that the source, the quote-unquote information, let me just say something about the source, which it seems relevant to call information because of the way it works, can be compressed in the sense that if you want to send certain sequences of zeros and ones, and the probabilities are such and such, whatever they are, then you don't actually have to send the actual sequences of zeros and ones. You can send something else, and that something else requires fewer resources than just send the sequences themselves. In effect, you're sending shorter strings than the actual strings. And the fact that you can reconstruct the actual strings from these shorter strings is, it seems to me, what is really underlying the notion of information. There's something there associated with the source which you can compress, and compress to a minimal amount. I mean, there's some point where you can't compress it anymore. Then you lose the information. I mean, in the sense that you can't reconstruct what's sent from the source. So I think the relevant notion is really compression. And
the thing I was kind of more specifically asking about is I don't see immediately how the sum of P mod P, how does that leverage information gain?
Oh, because the idea is that you just take minus log PI, and this is just a proposal. You can suppose you want to come up with some notion of the measure of the information associated with identifying the symbol AI produced by an information source. So suppose you've got various symbols produced with various probabilities, and you want to say, what should I take as a measure of the amount of information I gain when I identify a particular symbol? And it seems plausible, that's just a sort of plausibility argument, that you want a function which will behave in a certain way, that is, it should take the value of zero when you actually know the symbol in advance, at least when the probability of the symbol is one. And then you gain more information the more unlikely the symbol is. That's just the intuition. That's all behind that. So then it's minus log PI. That's just a plausible idea. And then you're averaging it because you're multiplying it by the probability. So that's a simple way of thinking about it. As I said, there's no particular there's nothing particularly theoretical underlying that, other than the fact that it's a function which takes it and which looks like a reasonable measure, and then you're averaging. But the more profound notion is really the notion that comes out of the theorem itself, which is compression. So anyway, the compression idea is very simply seen this way. I mean, it's the idea of a typical sequence. So if you you're not going to get any compression if the probabilities are all the same. If it's 0 and 1 and the probabilities are both half, then there's not going to be any compression possible. But if the probabilities are different, then you're going to get a smaller number of typical sequences than the total set of sequences. In fact, you're going to get 2nHx sequences of length n. So you could encode each of these typical n sequences as a certain number with the nHx binary digits. And so here's the sort of here's the point. If the probabilities are all equal, then so they're all 1 over k, so you've got minus 1 over k, and then sum of the log term, which is k times, just log 1 over k. Log of 1 is 0, so you've got k times 1 over k, which is 1, times log 1 over k, which is the minus 95, so that's going to give you log k. And if some pi is 1 and so all the others are 0, then you're going to get log 1, which means that the Shannon entropy is going to turn out to be between 0 and log k. So if we encode each of the k distinct symbols as a different binary number, we'd need log k bits to represent them, because 2 to the log k is k. So if you don't do any compression, then you're going to need log k bits. But if you just encode the typical sequences, you'd need fewer bits because you'd need nhx bits rather than n log k bits to encode each sequence, and that is a compression because hx is less than log k except for the equiprobable distributions. So, and that's not the theorem, I mean, that's just a plausibility argument. But the theorem shows that the compression rate produced by a source of an independent and identically distributed random variables is optimal, that's the best we can do.
Sorry, can I
interrupt
you again?
Yeah, sure.
This is totally, I don't know
what
program, but this is entirely new.
Oh, it's new to you. Okay, yeah. Good. Okay, sorry. I wasn't sure. I thought everybody knows all this.
Oh, no, I was kidding. Anyway, what was the reason that you said that that if you couldn't compress something, or if you just had 0 and 1 and the probability were equal, that you couldn't compress it?
Oh, because going back here, you need this many. The reason is that this number that hx is equal to log k, if they're all equal. I mean, you've got this piece of chalk here. You've got minus sigma pi log pi. If each of the pi's are 1 over k, right, then you've got 1 over k times this minus sign out here, and then you're summing k times over this thing, so there's a k, and then it's log 1 over k, and so you get minus log 1 over k, and this is equal to minus log 1, which is 0, minus log k. So this is equal to log k. So if they're all, but Shannon entropy is, the log k is the maximum, and the minimum is 0. If one of these is 1, and all the others are 0, then you just have 1 log 1, which is 0. And you can show that 0 is the minimum, that this function is bigger than 0, so 0 is the minimum. And the maximum value is actually when all these probabilities are exactly the same. So if they're all exactly the same, then HX is going to be log k, so you're going to need n log k bits to encode these sequences. You can't do any better. And then that's just the amount of bits you need just to encode every sequence. So you're not going to get any compression. So the compression comes about, in effect, this is the way to think about it. If you have a source which is producing zeros and ones with certain probabilities, and those probabilities are not all equal, then you can do something. And the intuition behind it is just very simple. I mean, if the, then the typical sequences, which are going to be probabilities of a quarter to three quarters, and they all have more or less a quarter zeros and three quarters ones, would be they'll just be 2 to the, if you think of sequences of length n, 2 to the nhx sequences of that sort, that was the previous analysis, and that's going to be a fewer number of bits required to actually encode all of that, the original sequence. So I have a simple example up here, which will maybe make it clear. So let's see. Well, this is just, I'm going to just jump this because this is just a precise statement. Well, let me just say this is just a precise statement of the theorem. The source, if you've got a source producing n-length sequences with those probabilities, where each symbol is chosen from some alphabet A, if they're K symbols, then the n sequences can be represented as sequences of n log K bits. Suppose there's what's called a block coding scheme, where each block or n-length sequence can be encoded as a shorter sequence of n times r, where r is between 0 and log k, because log k is the maximum number of bits you need, n log k for the sequences of n. And suppose that the receiver has some decompression scheme which can decode sequences of n r bits. You then speak of a compression-decompression scheme of radar, and the source coding theorem precisely states that if the Shannon entropy is Hx, then there's a reliable compression-decompression scheme of radar only if the rate is greater than the Shannon entropy or equal to the Shannon entropy. And if it's less than that, then it will not reliably reproduce the original sequences. So let me just jump back because, so here's a simple example. Consider an information source that produces sequences of symbols from a four-symbol alphabet. So you've just got A1, A2, A3, A4, and the probabilities are different, half, quarter, eighth, and eighth. Then each symbol can be represented by a two-digit binary number. So without compression, you would need two bits to store the input of the source. So that's log k, because k is 4 here, and log of 4 is 2, log to the base 2. It's 2 squared, so it's 2 times log 2, which is 2 times 1, which is 2. So now, work out the Shannon entropy. That's going to be minus pi log pi, summed over all the i's. You've got I is 4 here. So it's minus half log half, minus a quarter log quarter, minus 8 log 8, and that comes to 7 quarters. So it's just a little bit less. So the source coding theorem tells you that there is a compression scheme that uses an average of 7 over 4 bits per symbol rather than 2 bits per symbol. And that such a compression scheme is optimal. And here's an example. The optimal scheme is provided by the following encoding, where you encode A1 as a 0, A2 as a 1-0, A3 is 1-1-0, and A4 is a 1-1-0, 1-1-1. And now you can figure out the average length of a compressed sequence, because 0 is half the time, so it's half times 1 plus 40 times 2 plus 8 times 3, because they're 3 symbols, and 8 times 3, which is 7 over 4 bits per symbol. So for long strings, it's cheaper to produce. So that's a simple example of what's going on. I mean, the point is simply that you can send shorter sequences than you might think you would have to do. Okay. So now this is the point, I think, the basic point. The significance of the theorem lies in showing you that there's an optimal, most efficient way of compressing messages produced by the source, assuming a certain idealization. The idealization is that the source produces the symbols in such a way that they can be thought of as independent identity distributed random variables. Which means that if you have a sequence, like, just say a sequence of 10 slots, or a sequence of length 10, then, and let's say that that's just zeros and ones, right? Then what it means is that the probability of zero in a sequence of length 10 over many sequences is the same as if you pick one position, say position number 5, and you ask what's the probability of, over many sequences of zero showing up there. I mean, that has to be the same probability as zero showing up in one sequence. I must be talking about sequences of increasing length, not sequence of length 10. So as the sequences get longer and longer, the relative frequency of zero in one sequence is the same as the relative frequency, if I pick any particular position, the first position, the relative, and I consider many sequences, how many times will zero show up in that slot? So it's not that particular slots have different distributions of zeros and ones and so on. The sequence they're all producing will end up being random. So the Shannon entropy is a measure of the minimal physical resources in terms of the average number of bits per symbol that are necessary and sufficient to reliably store the output of a source of messages. That's the idea. And so in that sense, it's a measure of the amount of information produced by the source. You can't shrink things down more than that. You can't recover the messages if you produce sequences which are shorter. Okay, now, so if you haven't done this, let me go through this sort of fairly slowly. So I think that with that simple example, I think the idea is clear. I want to just consider a number of standard, information theoretic relations in terms of notions like the joint probability, the conditional probability, and the mutual information, and so on. So, consider the conditional probabilities of obtaining an output value y for a given input value space, right? So, we're thinking here is that the information channel is going to map inputs onto outputs. And that's what the receiver has. So the receiver from these Y values, because the idea is that the channel might be noisy, and so what you get at the other end is not what you're putting at the beginning. So you're going to be looking at Y and trying to infer X. From the probabilities, the probabilities of X, you can calculate Py as the probability of Y given X times the probability of X, summed up all over the X values. And you can also calculate the probability of X given Y by Bayes' rule from these probabilities and this. Bayes' rule is just the probability of X given Y is the probability of Y given X times the probability of X over the probability of Y. This is just from the joint probability formula, because this times this is equal to that times that. So if you have this probability and you have all the x's, in this case, if there are a whole bunch of x's, then this would be a sum. I want to say here that this is, I want the x given y, so you can express this as a you can express this as up over the X.
So if you know these conditional probabilities and you know the X's, then you can get the probabilities of X given Y from Y given X. And so you can calculate the Shannon entropy of the conditional distribution for X and a fixed Y, and denote it by that. So that would be the probability minus, you would just use these probabilities instead of the probabilities of X. So you're just going to be minus this thing. You're summing over all X values, log of this thing, summed over X values, and that would be this term there. Now, if you average that over the Y values, so this is the conditional Shannon entropy, where you're using the probabilities of the conditional probabilities of a fixed Y, and now you're just averaging up over all those Y's, and that's known as a conditional entropy. It's the average value of this quantity for all Y, whereas this quantity is just defined like the Shannon entropy, but with the conditional probabilities instead of the XY probabilities for a fixed Y. Okay. So, I mean, just to sum up that maybe slightly convoluted discussion, you have these probabilities, and you have these probabilities. So you figure out these probabilities, and that will give you a conditional Shannon entropy. If you a conditional Shannon entropy for a particular Y value, and then you average it up over Y. And so if you think of this as the entropy of this distribution, think of the entropy of this distribution as a measure of the uncertainty in the X value, then that's a measure of uncertainty in the X value given the Y value, and that's a measure of the average uncertainty of the X value given the Y value. Now, you could put this slightly differently. The number of input lengths, the input sequences of length n that are consistent with a given output sequence is going to be this. That's the number of bits per symbol of additional information that's needed on average to identify an X sequence from a given Y sequence. Now, why? Well, you could see that this way. There are this many typical sequences of pairs. This thing here is just the joint entropy calculated from the joint probability distribution. This is the probability of distribution of getting X and Y, of outputting X and getting a particular Y. So just using these probabilities, you can calculate this according to the usual definition, just with PXY instead of PX. And so there must be this many typical sequences of pairs, just as there were 2 to the NHX typical sequences of Xs. So there are this many divided by the typical sequences just of Y. Typical X sequences associated with typical Y sequences. It's the total number of XY sequences divided by the number of Y sequences. So that's the number of typical sequences associated with a given Y sequence. And this can be written as this, which is equal to that, which justifies this statement over here. Now, how do you get that? Well, that inequality, that the joint entropy minus the entropy of Y is equal to the conditional entropy, follows from this chain rule equality that the joint entropy can be written in this way. And that you can easily derive from just the definition of the quantities, I mean, so the calculation of about 5 or 6 lines. And all these things are, I mean, like that calculation is in the extended notes that I gave you in the URL. Now, this is not going to be equal to that, just point out. And, another important quantity is the mutual information. So, I know this is probably hard to keep the track of. By the way, if you want me to send you these lectures, I can just send you, I mean, I can send it to you, you know, just
electronic.
So two dots sometimes is denoted as I, you know, X, colon, Y, that's called the mutual expectation. So we have the conditional expectation, which is a slash, the joint entropy, which is a comma, and then the colon, sometimes with an I in front, is the mutual information. That's the average amount of information gained about X by the acidation of Y value. The amount of information one random variable contains about another. You can define that in terms of the concept of relative entropy, which is the slash. The relative entropy is different from the conditional entropy. The relative entropy, which I'll define this in a minute, is a measure of like something like the distance between two probability distributions. So it's defined this way. The relative entropy between the distributions Px and Qx is defined as Px log of Px minus Qx. So it's Px log Px minus Px log Qx. And now you can define the mutual information as the relative entropy of the joint probability distribution and the product. So you're really looking at something like the distance between this thing and just the product. If you just have a product, then the probability distributions are independent. Getting a Y value gives you no information about the X value. If they're not independent, then you have some information. So hence that definition. So this, writing that out, is PXY log joint probability divided by the product. And it's easy to see from that this mutual information is just the entropy of X plus the entropy of Y minus HXY. Why is it easy to see that? Well, if you look at this expression, it's just going to be PXY log PXY, which is minus the entropy of minus the joint entropy, because minus P log P is expression for the entropy. And then you're going to get minus PXY log PX, but you're summing up over Y. And so all those Y probabilities have to add up to 1. I mean, if you PXY, the joint probability summed over Y, it's just going to be PX, the marginal X probability. So PXY log PX, log PXY is going to get rid of the, what am I saying here? If I sum up over Y, I'm just going to get PX log PX. And if I PXY log PXY, if I sum up over X, I'm just going to get the log, I'm going to get the HY. I'm going to get PY log PY. And HXX is just HX, which, the amount of information about X that you get by looking at X is just HX. And then, because H of XY is this, which we saw before, then you can also write this mutual information, which tells you that the mutual information of two random variables, it's that quantity, is the average information gain about one variable obtained by measuring the other. That's the difference between the initial information minus the initial uncertainty minus the uncertainty, the residual uncertainty in X that you get when you've measured Y. And this is useful if you want to talk about noisy channels, because if you've got a noisy channel, if X represents the input of the channel, Y represents the output, then H, the mutual information, represents the average amount of information gained about the input by cascading the value of the output. And the capacity of a channel is defined as the supremum over all X's, over all input distributions. And the noisy channel coding theorem says that up to a certain amount of C, bits of information can be sent through a noisy channel with arbitrary low error rate. That is, there exists an optimal coding for an information source with the entropy H less than C. This such that n length sequences produced by the source can be transmitted faithfully over the channel. So we can improve the channel capacity by replacing the cable, say, which is the channel, by a faster cable, or we can improve the information processing by encoding it so that you can send sequence of information. And the C, of course, was the supreme of this particular here. Okay, let's see, that's... okay, so that's... I'm going to stop the post. So that's a brief introduction just to classical information. And just to sum up, I mean, there was the notion of Shannon entropy and the idea behind it of compression associated with the noiseless coding theorem or the source coding theorem. And then I defined a number of entropies, the conditional entropy, the mutual information, and so on, joint entropy, useful in various ways, one of which is to define the channel capacity. Then there is the second important theorem of channels, which says that you can actually, there's an optimal encoding for noisy channels, and that's given by this channel capacity. Okay, and you can, so you can use the noises, you can, if you encode things in a certain way, you can get your messages across with certainty, in the sense that the receiver will be able to understand what you're saying, even though the channel is noisy, if you do it appropriately. So that's the point of the second theory. Well, I mean, that's just some background kind of, I'm not getting to go into proofs of the theorems or anything more. Now I wanted to, I'll just go on for a while and then just pause. I want to move on to some basic quantum mechanics. And this might be a little more straightforward, or less unfamiliar. So take a quantum system which is part of a compound system. And so QE, think of E as the environment, but it could be any other system. And so a general pure state is then going to be represented in this way, where these are the some complete set of orthonormal states, basis in the Q Hilbert space, this in the E Hilbert space. And if the coefficients are such that this can be expressed as a product state, then that's, can't be expressed, that goes in a tangle state. So, for any state, there is an orthonormal basis in the two Hilbert spaces, such that this state can be expressed in this form. I mean, that's a theorem, where these coefficients are real and non-negative, and they sum to one. So that is that there's always a particular basis, and that's called the Schmidt decomposition. So there's a theorem, the Schmidt theorem, which says that you can always decompose a state, an entangled state, or any, I mean, in the case where it's just a product state, of course, there's just going to be, there won't be any sum. So the Schmidt decomposition is unique only if and only if all the PIs are distinct. If they're not, then there will be various Schmidt decompositions. So here's an example, the bi-orthogonal EPR state, singlet state of two spin-off particles. I mean, think of zero as up, one is down, so it's up, down, minus down, up for spin. And now I've got minuses in here, but I said the theorem said that was all pluses. So, but you can just absorb the minus into the phase of one of these states, and then you get plus. So there is a bit. I mean, the claim was that there is a basis in which you can represent it, a Schmidt basis. So the 0 and 1 here are related to the Schmidt basis in the sense that, you can
you can just introduce an e to the I pi and define a zero prime, say, related to zero by e to the I prime zero. So that gives you the minus one, and then you're going to have plus variations.
Now, this is not unique because the coefficients are all going to be the same. And you know that you can express this state in the same form with respect to different bases. So this might be spinning up and down in the x direction. This will take the same form for spin up and down in the z direction, or any direction. Sine retains the same form for spinning in the direction. So that gives you the uniqueness. Now these four states are very special. Here's the one I had before. I'm calling them 1, 2, 3, 4. They form an orthonormal basis in the four-dimensional Hilbert space, 2 by 2-dimensional Hilbert space called the Bell basis. And that's going to be crucial for quantum information. Any Bell state can be transformed into any other Bell state by a local unitary transformation, x, y, and z, where these are the Pauli matrices. So explicitly, I've got them here. And this is in terms of this Bra-Ket notation. For example, if I take number 4, actually, I think I called it number 1 before. I must have changed my memory. If you take Pauli spin matrix X in the one Hilbert space and then this identity in the other Hilbert space, then multiplying this through, seeing that what X does is to flip the spin, as you can see by looking at this, if I have this multiply 1, 0, I'll get 0, 1, and if I put 0, 0, 1, I'll get 1, 0. So this 0 goes to 1, and this 1 goes to 0, which means that I have a minus sign in front of 0, 0, and a plus sign in front of 1, 1, which means that I have then this state over here. And this goes to 0, this goes to 1. So I have 0, 0, minus 1, 1, which is minus one of the other Bell states. And that minus is just the phase, an overall phase, which is irrelevant to the actual state. If you think of a state as just an array in Hilbert space, and it's spanned by the plus vector or minus vector. This is the closest to the entangled state represented in the Schmidt decomposition. We can compute the expectation value of any q observable in this way. It's going to be a trace of the projection operator onto the state times a cross I. And I'm here taking the trace with respect to the e space, and the trace with respect to the q Hilbert space. So if I take this trace and I write this thing down here as psi of psi, and I just take the trace over, well, these i's, which means that I sum up, I take a basis, any basis, and I take qi, and I just, I'll call ei, let's say, for if I take the trace over E. So if I take the EI with respect to this basis, then what happens is that I get either zeros or ones depending on the I, whether I is the same as EI. And which means that if you work it out, which is elementary, you get this. But I'm going to get, you can almost do it in your head. If I write psi this way and psi this way, I'm going to get the square root of pi, ii, and then I'm going to take bras, and then sum over, let's say, j. So I'm going to get sigma pi, sigma p, and not sigma, sigma root of pi, root of pj, and then I'm going to get ii, jj. But now I'll take the trace, put a vector, take k for this. I'm going to get k on this side and k on that side, and I'm summing up over k. So I'm going to get either 1 or 0, depending on whether k is the same as j. And so I'm going to get two
delta functions. I'm going to do it again, sorry. Delta ik and delta jk. And if I'm summing up over the I of j, I'm going to just end up with that. Because all the terms will cancel except when the subscript is the same. So then the root pi, root pj will go to pi, and I will just have the I of the q Hilbert space. So this is a little bit misleading. This I refers to q, and this I refers to e. The second Hilbert space. So it's just the order is telling you which Hilbert space. So this I've summed up over the e Hilbert space, taken the trace. So this I is for the q Hilbert space. And now if I sum up over that, then I'm just going to get a trace of rho A, where, what have I got here, where rho is just this expression here. So the point of this is if I express this in the, if I have any state of the system QE, and I can always write it in the Schmidt decomposition. So if I take the trace, the partial trace over E, then I can express the expectation value of A with respect to a trace in Q alone using not the initial state, but this mixed state here, which is going to be this. So let's say, so that's called the reduced state, the reduced density operator of the open system Q. It's going to be a positive operator with unit trace. So that gives us statistics of all Q observables. It's taken as representing the quantum state of the system Q. If this is an entangled state, then that system is a mixed state. And for pure states, it's just going to be the projection operator onto an array. So now this representation here, you can think of this as just, I think this row should be pi, should be a probability. So this probability over these basis states. You can think of that as a mixture of pure states with probabilities pi. But that's not unique. For example, suppose you have an equal weight mixture of orthonormal states 1 and 2, and that has the, so with 50% probability 0 and 50% probability 1, that has exactly, that has a density operator half 0, 0, you know, 0, 0 plus half 1, 1, which is just the half of the identity, because 0, 0 plus 1, 1 is the identity. And that has exactly the same row if you mix these states with equal weights. Or if you mix these non-orthogonal states, 0, 0 plus square root of 3 over 2, this state here, which are states 120 degrees apart, or any uniform distribution, they'll all have the same density operator. That is, if you take in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, if you mix these two states with probability half, you get half the identity. If you mix these two states, really, you get half the identity, which is 1 over 0 plus 1 over 2. If you mix these three non-orthogonal states, this 120, then you get that entity. And if you mix any uniform distribution of all the states, or any mixture like that, you're going to get the same error. Okay. More generally, for any basis of orthonormal states in E, you can express this entangled state in this way. Now, this is not the Schmidt decomposition.
the Schmidt decomposition required is it exists for a particular pair of bases. That is, you know, this must be orthogonal in the Q Hilbert space, and this must be orthogonal in the E Hilbert space. But this thing says it's something else. If you just pick any orthogonal basis in E, then you can always write this in this form, but these R's aren't orthogonal necessarily. These would be normalized states, but they won't necessarily be orthogonal. They're called relative states E. So they're not in general orthogonal. But because the E's are orthogonal, we can, if you take the trace over the E's, then, I mean, if you just, you know, take, write this as a projection operator onto psi, in terms of, you know, kits, bras, take the trace over E, the calculation is going to be just as before, and so you're going to get rho as this mixture, weighted mixture of R states. But these R states are not orthogonal. So now the interesting thing about that is, in effect, a measurement of an E observable with eigenstate Ci will leave the composite system in one in one of these states. If you get Ei, then the composite system will end up in this state, because E, this is the relative state to this, with probably one I, W. But if you measured the E observable with eigenstates I, the orthogonal states of the Schmidt decomposition and not the EIs, that will leave this system in one of the states II. Remember, this I refers to the Q system and this is the E system, with probability PI. So depending on what you measure on the E system, you could leave the other system, Q, in one of two mixtures. But now you can say, since these can be separated from each other, no measurement of E could affect the statistics of any Q observable. Or else measurements of E would allow superluminal signaling. It follows that the mixed state rho can be realized as a mixture of orthogonal states I, the eigenstates of rho with weights pi, or as a mixture of non-orthogonal states with weights wi, wj, in infinitely many ways, depending on what basis you're choosing to achieve. So you can write this as this, or as this, and all these different mixtures of the same density operator must be physically indistinguishable. So this is sort of a physical argument. We're saying that, look, you can express this composite state in different ways. Now, think of making a measurement of the system E. That will amount to, that will give you a density operator for the system Q. But they are they're different mixtures depending on what you measure on the system E. But seeing that, we assume no signaling, those must all be indistinguishable for someone making measurements on Q alone. So these things must be the same. I just pointed out that any mixed state density operator can be what's called purified by adding a suitable ancilla system E, so that Ray is the partial trace of pure state over HG. And that's not going to be unique, but it's going to be depend on how you purify it. Here's an important theorem which plays a role in a lot of information theoretic results, the Houston-Yosa-Wouters theorem. That shows that for any set of any mixture of pure states with weights wi, there's a purification of rho and a pseudo measurement of the system E that will leave Q in the mixture rho. An observer at E can remotely prepare Q in any mixture that corresponds to this density operator rho, and they're all going to be physically indistinguishable. See, if I have some mixture like this, I can think of it as, in terms of there being some other system E, with respect to which I traced over, which gave me back. And so, just as in the previous transparency, if I could think of this thing as a result of making a measurement of tracing over this other system E with a particular basis or with a different basis, so all these mixtures are going to be the same. But what must be the case then is that I can, so to speak, steer, if I've got two systems,
I mean, this is something that this Houston USO Wurter's result is something that was anticipated by Schrodinger. Schrodinger, in response to Einstein Podolsky Rosen in 1935, wrote a two-part paper where he essentially pointed this out, and he has a kind of a complicated proof which is much more neat and simply done by Houston and USO Wurter's. But the same result is really in von Neumann, in Schrodinger. And what Schrodinger pointed out was that, look, if you've got two systems and they're in an entangled state, and we've been considering general states that could be entangled all the way through, then so this system is going to be in some state Cij, with my symbols, Qi, you know, Ej, some ij. And this state of these two systems, which is the entangled state, you can now think of in the following way. There's going to be some mixture rho, let's say this is A and B. There's going to be some mixture rho V, well, I switch from Q to E and rho V, but this in information theory, it's always going to be Alice above. So there's going to be some density operator associated with the reduced state when you trace over A of this system here. That can be expressed as different mixtures. I mean, to take the example that we had before, if this was a two-dimensional system, this is a two-dimensional system, this, I said, could be expressed as a mixture of 50% this state and 50% this state, or 50% this state over here, where this is 1 over root 2, 0, plus 1 over root 2, 1, and this is 1 over root 2, 0, minus 1 over root 2, 1. This mixture here might be identity over 2. And that is just 50% this plus 50% this. It's half, 0, 0, plus half, 1, 1, or half, this point and this one. Or 1/3 of this, 1/3 of this, and 1/3 of this. They all have the same row, which is just the row that you get when you trace over the state. Now, what the Houston-Yosa Wooders theory tells you is that you can create, if you like, any of these mixtures. I mean, this mixture over here, or this mixture over here, or this mixture over here, by making a suitable measurement of the system. Now, the suitable measurement to get this, you just write this, re-express this in terms of the Schmidt decomposition with respect to these two states and two orthogonal states of this system. Suppose this particular state is 1 over root 2, 0, 1, sorry, what am I writing here? 1 minus 1, 0. Suppose it was that state that we considered before. Then obviously, Alice can create this particular mixture here of 0 and 1 by just measuring 0 and 1 on her system. If she gets 0, then this system is in the state 1. If she gets 1, that system is in the state 0. But you can rewrite this in terms of two states over here, which are orthogonal, and these two states over here. And then if Alice measures in that basis, that's going to be Alice's basis will be this. And Bob, if you choose this as Bob's basis, then it will turn out that Alice's basis is the same because this has a symmetric form. So if I call those the prime basis, then I'm going to have the same form of the prime basis. So if Alice measures not 0 and 1, but 0 prime, 1 prime, then she'll steer, as Schrodinger said, this system into this mixture. Now you might say, well, how is she going to steer it into this mixture? Well, the
the theory tells you that there is a way of doing that. I mean, that's the clever thing about theory, because this bit of theorem is sort of trivially might have seen that, you know, that just in terms of the Schmidt decomposition, you can do it directly. But that is exploited often, but it shows that for any mixture of pure states with weights, there is a purification of rho and a super measurement on the system E that will leave this in the mixture of rho. So the purification is going to be, it's going to be a purification of rho, so it won't necessarily be the state psi. So there are many purifications. The purification is not unique. Now, physically, what's going on here, if you want to get a mixture of this on this side, if Alice wants to steer the system into this mixture, which would be a third of this plus a third of this plus a third of this, this is in a two-dimensional orbit space, right? What Alice does is to get another system, called an ancilla system, and then perform a super measurement on these. And if Alice does that, these measurements that Alice performs on this orbit space have got three possible outcomes. And then those three possible outcomes are going to be correlated with these three states up here. So there is a way of doing that where Alice can steer the system to that state. And that was already noticed by Schrodinger. And in fact, Schrodinger took that as one of the reasons that quantum mechanics really couldn't be correct, because he said, look, it doesn't make any sense that Alice over here can do stuff in her part of the universe, and as he said, steer this system into any mixture compatible with the density matrix. So it's not the case that Alice can steer the system in such a way that Bob will be able to detect the steering, because the only thing that Bob has available is the density matrix, which is the probabilities, and it's the same probabilities. So if Bob is making measurements, then Bob doesn't see any change. It's just the probabilities of any outcome is given by a trace rho and whatever the observable is. So the statistics is the same for Bob. But the correlations are different. What Alice can do is control the correlations. She can control whether this is correlated with some outcome there, and this is correlated with a different outcome, or with these two, and so on. In other words, she's changed something which seems intuitively, from a classical standpoint, kind of peculiar, because she can do the following. I mean, if she has a telephone, I mean, this is the reason why you can't signal superluminally, because you need a telephone to talk to Bob. But if she can talk to Bob over the telephone, she can say, hey, look, I've done something to your system, and I bet you didn't know it. And he can say, well, I don't see how you could if you were a million miles away or something. And so she could say, well, look, if you measure in this direction, I can tell you the outcome, because she has just made a measurement, and she has the corresponding state here. So if Bob then orients his apparatus to measure whether or not the state on his side exists, he'll get yes. Or she can say, I can tell you that if you now measure the observable associated with this, then you're going to get this outcome, and you'll, you know, always be correct. So in that sense, Alice has steered Bob's system into a particular mixture. It's either this mixture, or this mixture, or this mixture. Okay. So that's what I'm saying here. Observer D can remotely prepare Q in any mixture that corresponds to the density operator, or there's always going to be physically distinguishable. I jumped to something else about measurement. The standard von Neumann measurement is associated with the projection operator. Standard observers are represented in the spectral representation as a sum of projection operators. The spectral representation of any observable, say A, is just going to be sigma AI PI, where these are projection operators, and then these are the eigenvalues. And if the eigenvalues are all distinct, these projection operators are all going to be on one-dimensional subspaces. If they're not distinct, then if you talk about a three-dimensional Hilbert space,
and there are only two distinct eigenvalues, so the operator is degenerate, then one of these p's will be a projection operator onto a plane, and then say you'd have let's say a1 a could be a1 p1 plus a2 p2. If I'm in a three-dimensional Hilbert space and a has two eigenvalues, and one of these, let's say this one, is two-dimensional, and this is going to be one-dimensional, and so on for more general cases. And so I could write this as, let's say P, it's a two-dimensional plane, let's say P plus P2, where this is a one-dimensional projection, this is an orthogonal one-dimensional projection, but I could write this in an infinite number of different ways, like this, and so on. And so this representation, if I write it that way, then will not be unique. But it will not be unique as a sum of projection operators onto one-dimensional projectors, but it will always be unique if I simply think of this as a subspace. So that's the spectral projection. And a measurement of one of those projection operators is the quantum analog of a measurement of a property, classically. Classically, we can think of a property of the system as being associated with a subset in the state space, and determining whether the system has a property and also determining whether the state of the system lies in the subset. And in quantum mechanics, the counterpart of a subset is a subspace, closed ring subspace. And just as the different possible values of an observable of a classical system correspond to the subsets in some mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive set of subsets covering the classical state space, so the different values of a quantum observable correspond to a subspace that's in a mutually exclusive, that is orthogonal and collectively exhaustive set of subspaces. I'm just saying this, that classically, your state space is a phase space, and the state is a point in the phase space, and properties, let's say the property of being a particle being in this room, is going to be associated with a subset. So if the state is in the subset, then the property is true. If it's outside, then the property is false. And since every property is associated with some subset, every property is either true or false. So that's the way you can think of classical states, and an observable is going to just partition the state space into regions like that, where this is value one of the observable, value two of the observable, value three, four, and so on. Another observable partitioned in a different way. State is always somewhere, and so the observable always has a value. But quantum mechanically, the counterpart of the subspace subsets are going to be subspaces, like three-dimensional space, that subspace, some plane. The state is going to be pure state. The analog of a point is going to be a one-dimensional subspace or a line. And the line can be an angle to a subspace. And so it's not the case that given a line, you pick out, assign a 1 and a 0 to every single subspace. But that's essentially the difference between the classical quantum description, but the analog of one of these observables is going to be an observable like this, which has can be related to a bunch of projection operators with values, just as this classical observable is related to can be represented as a sum of characteristic functions which are projection operators onto all the subsets. So, I mean, I can write any classical observable this way, where this thing is just a function. These are the different values of the observables, classically. I mean, suppose I have a classical observable which is 1 if I'm in this room, and 2 if I'm in the next room, and 3 if I'm anywhere else in the universe. Then the observable would be 1 times P1 plus 2 times P2 plus 3 times P3. This P1, P2, and P3 would be functions which take the value 1,
this function here takes the value 1 in this room, 0 elsewhere. This takes 1 in the other room, 0 elsewhere. And this 1 in the rest of the universe, 0 elsewhere. So I can write this classical observable with 3 possible values this way. And that will tell you that the observable has the value 1 in a certain region, 2 in a certain other region, 3 in a certain other region. And that's just, this is just a generalization of this, where instead of functions, which are commutative, I have projection operators. I mean, these are 0, 1 functions. This is a 0, 1 operator. Eigenvalues are 0, 1. And this corresponds not to a subset of a set, but a subspace of a space. Okay. That's what it's saying here. But now here, how about we finish this today? Instead of considering those kinds of measurements, that is, measurements associated with determining, would be the analog of classical measurement, where I'm really just making a measurement of whether or not this observable has a value. So I'm basically trying to pick out the projection, the particular projection operator.
So I can imagine, when we talk about classical systems, the projection into configuration subspaces.
Well, those would be configuration subspaces, but you could also think of, a spin, say, maybe more than spin half, say, spin 1 or something. So then there would be, a spin value 0 plus 1 minus 1, so I have a subspace like that. And then if I consider observables, they're going to be associated. Every observable then can be written, this is also a theorem, the spectral representation theorem. But every observable, which is an emission operator, because it's an emission operator, can always be written as a sum, where these numbers need to be positive. These are the eigenvalues of the observable, times projection operators. And so in that sense, an observable, in that sense, can be understood as an analog of the classical observable, just in a non-commutative setting, because instead of thinking about sets and subsets and functions, just a classical picture, I've got subspaces and operators on the subspaces, but it's a non-commutative analog of that. I didn't say where I'm going because I didn't. So what I want to talk about now are generalized measurements and POVM measurements, and I want to just make the distinction between those sorts of measurements and projection value measurements. A projection value measurement is going to be a measurement where you pick a particular, you either pick a particular basis or you partition the Hilbert space into orthogonal subspaces. So maybe you want to make a measurement, maybe you're measuring a spin 1 particle and you want to know whether the spin is 0 or not. You don't need to say whether it's plus 1 or minus 1. You just want to know, is it 0 or not? Then you're making a measurement which is sort of deciding between this subspace, the minus 1, plus 1 subspace, and the 0 subspace. This saves your state. And then what you mean by measurement in quantum mechanics of that sort of measurement is the state is not in this subspace, and it's not along the 0. It's just some linear superposition, which can angle to this three-dimensional space. When you make a measurement, as you know, I'm sure the state projects either onto this or it projects onto that with probability which is given by the angle, cosine squared of the angle. So that's what happens when you make a measurement quantum mechanically. But when you're talking about what I call projective value measurements, where the measurement in this case would be of an observable called A, and call this, which is going to be, let's say, 1 P0 plus 2 P orthogonal subspace. And then if you make a measurement of this observable, you're setting up your operators in some way to distinguish to distinguish this from this plane. So that's this line, this is this plane, plus minus plane. I'm saying that this observable has two eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are just
conventional numbers, plus one, minus one, anything, just tags, if you like. But the measurement is then going to give you either this value or this value. And then the state will be changed. It's either going to be lying on this plane, or it's going to be lying on this line as a result of the measurement. But it's called a projective valued measurement because what you're associating with the measurement are these projection operators. And you're writing these, and these observables that you're talking about can be written as sums of these projection operators, which I said is analogous to the classical situation. Only there, once you have a state, that state actually encodes actual values of the subsets. Because, this quantity classically will have a value always. And that's expressed mathematically by the fact that the state is just a point in a space where these things are going to be associated with subsets. And the point is, by definition, in a subset or outside a subset. This thing is a generalization where what corresponds to the subsets are subspaces. And now the subspaces can be an angle to the state. So you have it. And that's essentially the difference that you get with quantum mechanics. And then when you make a measurement, you say, well, the state is not in the subspace. But when I make a measurement and the measuring apparatus gives me the answer yes, then I know that the state projected into the subspace. And that is how that happens is, of course, the measurement problem. I do want to talk about that at some point, but I'm just now describing what's going on. Does that sort of make sense?
Okay, so I see that classically you consider the phase space and the state is one point in phase space, and when you assign that point to be within some neighborhood on top of it,
yeah.
That sense you talk about projective determination of belonging to some.
Yeah. Yeah,
part of phase space. So that's mathematical characterization of quantum measurements.
Yeah,
and then quantum mechanics.
You do the same thing, except that it's useful to consider a more general class of measurements in quantum mechanics than these projective measurements. And these are so-called POBM measurements, or generalized measurements. I want to say what these things are. You can characterize a quantum measurement completely generally as a certain sort of interaction between the measured system and the measuring system. I'm going to say what that certain sort is. So you suppose that Q is initially in state psi, and that M is initially in some standard state zero, where little M is an orthonormal basis of pointer eigenstates in this measurement Hilbert space. So you start off in the zero state, and then they're going to be 1, 2, 3, 4 other states associated with the pointer. Now, the measuring direction is going to be a unitary transformation on this Hilbert space that's going to lead to some transition like that. Now, just let me make clear that these M's are a set of linear operators called Krauss operators, defined in HQ. So while this looks like psi didn't change, it just looks like psi and M, this MM looks notationally as if it has to do with that. You must realize that this quantity here, MM psi, because MM is operating just on psi, not on M. So the unity transformation is going to take psi zero to some linear superposition of M's pointer readings with corresponding psi states. So these states are the relative states in the terminology I employed before to M, and they need not be orthogonal. They will be orthogonal in the case of a projective measurement, but that's the point. They needn't be orthogonal here. And all you require is that the unit transformation is defined so that these M's, called measurement operators or Krauss operators, satisfy this condition. The sum over the adjoint time, MM. So these M's, important to realize that they're not in the Hilbert space of the measuring instrument. They operate on size. Now, all I need is this relationship here for this to be a unitary transformation. Why? Well, that condition called completeness guarantees that it's unitary because
if I take a unitary transformation on psi of 0 and I consider the scalar product of the transformed psi 0 onto the transformed phi 0, then that I want that to be the same as that if the transformation is unitary. I mean, characteristic of a unitary transformation is that if I transform psi by u and I transform phi by u, then the scalar product is continuous. So this requirement is telling me that this thing is unitary, and this u is defined by the sum of mn's. And so if I'm summing over these m's, what have I got here? This thing and this thing is in the Q orbit space. This is in the Q orbit space. So I can move this over to here, and I've got mn prime summed over n prime. That's going to be 0 on this m is the same as n prime. And I just get 1 out of that. So hence I get this expression summed over m. And if I assume completeness, which is sum, the sum is 1 from the identity, then I get that. So u as defined above is a unitary transformation. And any set of linear operators then defined on a Hilbert space Q, satisfying that condition, defines a mesh. That's all you need. Why call it a mesh? Well, if you perform a standard projective measurement in this sense on n to determine the value of the pointer observable, defined by this projection operator. So I just find out what that is by performing a projective measure. Then the probability of getting the outcome m is, now we just have to work it out, it's going to be the square of the probability of getting this outcome, in this case, is just the square of the project, it's cosine squared of this angle, which is just the square of the projection of this line. I mean, what's the probability of getting this? Well, I project this on this line, I take the square. I mean, if this thing is alpha, then it's going to be alpha squared. I mean, that's just the Born rule. I didn't make this precise. If this thing is this is a unit vector in this direction, call it I, and this thing here is alpha projected. Then with the complex number, then the probability of projecting is going to be alpha squared, and it's alpha, alpha star. So that's what I'm doing here. I take the projection of this state onto the M eigenspace. It's going to be an eigenspace because I'm picking M in the E Hilbert space and considering the whole Q Hilbert space. And then I take the same thing this way. I just take, that's like taking, what am I doing here? I'm taking alpha I and then taking alpha star I. I'm working out that. but the star part, because this is going to be u with a dagger, and another p with a dagger, but p dagger is just p, and p squared is just p. So that's why I just got one p. I mean, I could write it p dagger here, but I don't need that, because p dagger is p. Singular p is a projection operator, the square of p is p, because it's a projection operator. So I get this expression here. And what have I done over here? I'm writing this thing out in this way, the Pn. And that gives me these sums of m's and on this side, so I get an n prime and double prime. And now I just move the m's together over because they're just acting in E-Hilbert space. this thing is in Q Hilbert space, this thing is in Q Hilbert space, I sum up over n in prime, and I get that. I mean, all this Spanish is except it makes n double prime and n prime, just n. The same value. So the probability is just going to be that. So what this is saying is if I have this transformation, if I have this transformation here with n satisfying this condition, then the probability of getting the outcome n is just going to be this. And that's the same as the probability for a projective measurement where this would just be p. I mean, if I make a measurement and I project psi onto p psi or pm psi, then the probability of getting that outcome is just the square root of projection of pm psi. I mean, it's just pm psi squared, so it's just pm and pm dagger and psi. If I make a projective measure, that would be the probability. So that's why it makes sense to call this a generalized measurement. And if the initial state is a mixed state rho, then from that previous definition, just in terms of the definition of rho, we can get the probability in the usual trace formula as trace m rho m dagger, where for projective measurement, this would be p rho p dagger. And the final state after the projective measurement on m, the final state of the whole system is then going to be, this is a projective measurement on m, but pm u psi is just mm psi. So this is just a generalization of the usual thing that you get where you would have a projection operator here, projection operator.
So that's from extending the space Q another measurement.
Well, let's see. The idea is this: that you, if you have any interaction between Q and E, Q and M,
yes,
any interaction at all which satisfies that completeness condition. I mean, any interaction of the form where you have these M's. It's a unit transformation, has to be a transformation of these M's, and the M's have to satisfy this completeness condition, and the N's can be any operator satisfying a completeness condition. They don't have a special case would be projection operators, but in the case of projection operators, you have sigma pi pi is equal to one because this thing is the same thing. So you know pi is equal to pi of pi. And pi squared is equal to pi. So this is just the sum of the projection operators are 1. And you have an additional, all right, let me write this down properly. In the case of projection, you have sigma mi is equal to the in. And as a special case, sigma pi is equal to the in. This follows because sigma pi is equal to the identity, right? These are projection operators which partition space. It's this one plus this one for a projective measure. But in addition, you have pi pj is equal to 0 when I is not equal to j. That is, these are orthogonal. This is orthogonal to this. So this additional condition for projective measurements that pi pj is equal to naught if I is not equal to j is not required to be satisfied by these m's. Okay, so now the idea is that you just have some m's, and there's no reason to talk about them as measurements. Just think of them as some kind of unitary transformation. And then the argument is that, well, now if you make a normal measurement, projective measurement on the system M, that is to say, if you look at the pointer, because the pointer states are all orthogonal, then, and you ask what's the probability of a particular outcome, then the probability is going to be, well, I'll put it in a simple way, it's going to be just in terms of, can be expressed in terms of the Q Hilbert space alone, has something that looks like a measurement, where instead of projection operator here, you have this thing. So if you have this entanglement between the Q and the M system, the system you're measuring and the other system, of this specific sort, and you pick a pointer of the measuring instrument, then in terms of the system that you're, the other system, the probability of getting a particular outcome can be expressed in terms of the state of the other system alone and these Krauss operators of that system. And more generally, if the state of the, if Q is a mixed state, then you can express it in terms of this mixed state formula. And after that interaction and the measurement on the M system, the Q system will be left in the state MM psi over this normalization condition. So it's a generalization of this notion here. I mean, after this measurement, the state will be here, mm-hmm. or the state will be here.
Each measurement is considered as a projection onto a subspace?
Well, the measurements here are projections. The measurements, in the case of projective measurements,
yes.
Generalized. But the generalized ones, no. The generalized ones,
the generalized measurements, you characterize with those M.
You characterize with those M.
And
yeah.
they can be understood by extending to the
entangled state. Exactly. Now, let me just give you an example, because you might, I say that it covers the standard case of the projective measurements and also so called generalized observables associated with. Positive operator value dimensions, because so far here I'm just talking about generalized measurements. There's a notion of generalized observables associated with, which are generalization of the standard observables. But now, and this is done this way. In terms of those M operators, you can define an E operator. And the set E and then the set defines a set of positive operators called effects, such that they add to 1, because this adds to 1. And a positive operator valued measure can be regarded as a generalization of a projective valued measure, in the sense that this defines a resolution of the identity, kind of divides up the identity, without requiring this orthogonality condition, which is what I wrote before. Because these P's sum to 1, to identity, but they also are orthogonal, and these are E's, which sum to I, but don't have to be orthogonal. And you can write probability of the measurement outcome in terms of these E's in this way, just because, as we had it before, this thing was MMMM. Now, just to end up, I must have, forget about that. Here's an example, okay, we should make it clear. In terms of what I've said before, there's only a formal analogy with projective valued measurements. But you might wonder what this really has to do with measurements. I mean, you might say, well, look, I had an interaction between Q and M, and then I made a standard measurement on M, and now I can figure out the probabilities for Q in terms of the Q state. But why should I think of that as a generalized measurement? Why shouldn't I just talk about it as some kind of entanglement and then a measurement on the M system in the usual sense? Granted, there are some formal analogies in the expression, but why is this interesting? Well, here's why. Suppose we know that a system with a two-dimensional Hilbert space is in one of two non-orthogonal states. It's impossible to reliably distinguish these states by a quantum measurement, even in the above generalized sense. Here, a reliability means that the states identified correctly with zero probability of error. Now, I have a proof here, which I'll just jump through. That just says that you can't identify them with, because I want to go into something more interesting. So there's a little proof that you can't identify them. And I mean, you might suppose that because they're two non-orthogonal states, two states like that, in a two-dimensional space. I mean, so
But it is possible to perform a measurement in the generalized sense, and now you'll see why it makes sense to call it a measurement, with three possible outcomes that will allow us to correctly identify the state some of the time for two possible outcomes, while nothing about that identity of the state can be inferred from the third outcome. Now, this actually, I think, is a very important example. I mean, not this particular example, but just this kind of thing, because it actually comes up, this kind of thing comes up over and over again, actually, in quantum cryptography and in quantum computation, actually. And so this example, I think, is important to understand this example. Consider the three operators. And these are the three, they define a positive operator value to measure. Now, remember, the states that I want to identify, just to remind you before, I've got state 0 and 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1. So it's just these states. State 0 is that. This is 1. And this is the state 0 plus 1 over root 2. I give you a state, and I tell you, it's this one or this one. You tell me what it is. And so you have to figure out how to identify it. Okay? So that's the measurement task. It's a different task than, say, measuring the spin of a particle. You know, spin half particles, is it up or down in direction z? This is a different kind of measurement problem, but equally legitimate. I give you a particle, I say the state is either psi or phi. Can you perform something called a measurement which will tell you what it is? So here's what you do. You define three operators, which are as follows. This operator is going to be a multiple of the projection operator onto this state of orthogonality, as 0 minus 1. This operator is going to be a projection operator, some multiple. It's not a projection operator. This is a projection operator. And this part is a projection operator. It's a multiple of a projection operator. And the multiples are chosen as the thing to work out. So this is some multiple of the state of 1. And this E3 is just one identity minus E1 minus E2, and so that this plus this add up to the identity. So they define a positive operator value of measure. Now, they reach multiples of these projection operators. There were two states, psi 1 and psi 2. Psi 1 was 0, and psi 2 was 0 plus 1 over root 2. So they're multiples of this, this, and this third one turns out to be multiple of the projection operator onto this state, 0 plus 1. Well, this number times 0 plus 1, and that's just the normalization. So they've got coefficients. That. And the measurement involves a system M with three orthogonal positive pointer states, 1, 2, 3. And you define a unitary interaction this way with these M operators, where M are the root of EN. The root of an operator is just that if you square that operator, you get the original one, if you multiply it by itself. Now, if the input is 0, then you have this transition over here. Now, this E1 was these things are operating on, what am I going to get? These E's are operating on the Q system. So this operator here, which was a multiple of 1, operating on this thing over here, is going to give you a state like this, where this is going to be some state, and this is going to be some state. Which is just going to be, phi 1 is this orthogonal state, the orthogonal state of 2, and phi 2 is the orthogonal state to 1. So, I'm operating with that operator, E1, on this. Let me look at what E1, let me get back some track on myself with these things. E1 is this operator here. It's a multiple of a projection operator onto this thing. So it has zeros and ones in it, right? Now, if I operate onto zero, I don't get zero because I'm projecting that state here onto this state here. So I get this. And I'm getting mixed up. This is not correct. What I just said, just forget all what I said. If the input state is phi 1, then I have 0, 0 under that unitary transformation, which is a sum of these n's, which are related to these square root things, which will end up as this operator, which is just square root of E1 on 0, 1, plus square root of 3 on 0, 3. That means I end up with a state like that. Because the E2, I mean, the measurement operator is E1 plus E2 plus E3, square root. But the E2 bit on psi 1 gives me 0, because this is orthogonal to psi 1. Okay. The alpha and the beta are real numbers. If I'm interested in psi 2, then when I operate with the sum of the measurement operators, which is square root E1 plus E2 plus E3, then the E1 part gives me 0, because the E1 is orthogonal to the vector, to this vector over here. That gives me 0. So I end up with this thing. So if I perform that generalized measurement, I either, at the state of psi 1, end up with a linear superposition of 1 and 3, or if it's psi 2, I end up with a linear superposition of 2 and 3. Right? Now, let me look here. If I make a measurement now on this system, in this case, I'm either going to get the answer 1 or the answer 3. If I got the answer 1, I know that the original state was psi 1. Because psi 2, because I don't get it, I will never get a 1 if the original state is psi 2. On the other hand, if I get an answer 2, I know that the original state was psi 2, because I never get a 2 outcome here. If I get a 3, then I don't know. So here's a way of, you see that a projected measurement of the pointer of n that yields the outcome 1 indicates certainly that the input state is psi 1, and it leaves the system in the state phi 0. If I get an answer n 2, I know it was this state. And if I get the answer 3, then the input state could have been psi 1 or psi 2, and it's left in the state phi 3. So that's we should stop there. But the generalized measurement then is going to be, I mean, the way I understand it, I mean, you can think of it in various ways, is this. I have a system here, and there's a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Two-dimensional Hilbert space. And if I want to measure quantities on this thing with, let's say, spin half in various directions, then I do a standard projective measure. But there's something else that I can do. If I'm given a system in two-dimensional space, and I'm, say, asked to tell whether the state is this state or this state, but these are now orthogonal, then what I do is I can perform a generalized measurement by performing a unitary transformation between this system, which has a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and this system, which has a three-dimensional Hilbert space. I just would say I perform a certain kind of entanglement between this system and this system, and then I make a measurement on this system in the standard sense, where there are now going to be three possible outcomes. And from those three possible outcomes, I can infer something about this system here. So that's understood as a generalized measurement, and one can express what is going on purely in terms of the changes to this open system over here. That is to say, I can express the probabilities of the various outcomes, and I can express the change in state
of the system. I mean, I can say where the state will be left after the measurement. So a measurement in that generalized sense is just any entanglement of a certain sort with these M operators that will entangle one system with another system called a measuring instrument in an appropriate way, such that when you make a projective measurement on the system you're calling the measuring instrument, which is sort of looking at the pointer, then you can infer something back about the system. And the cases in which it would be useful, for example, are cases where you want to distinguish between two nullifiable states. And you can prove that there's no way of distinguishing with certainty between two orthogonal states. There was a little calculation that I had that I junked. But there will be a way of being able to identify with certainty whether it's this state or this state in some cases. That is, there will be various outcomes, three. And in the case of one, you'll be able to say, for sure, it's this state. In the case of another outcome, you'll be able to say, for sure, it's this state. And then there'll be some other outcome where you say, I don't know. So this is something which is useful all over. And I mean, I'll just give you a, see if in a second, a minute, I can sort of say where. In quantum computation, for example, it turns out that you can, if you want, the very simplest algorithm is Deutsch's algorithm, which determines whether a function has a certain global property called constant or balanced. If the function is constant, you end up with a state like this. If you end up with balanced, you end up with a state like this. And there's a 60-degree angle between the states. And so the quantum computation gives you this state or this state. If you could tell what it was, then you would be able to know whether the function has a global property. Well, you need a measurement that will distinguish this. And so if you take a three-valued a POV M measurement, that is to say, you have outcomes which are three possible values, then you can distinguish the state half the time. That's because I draw this here, this is a three orthogonal lines, this line, which is halfway between here and there in this plane, call this C or something. And this line, which is halfway between here and here, call it B balanced. If you consider this vector and this vector, there's a 60-degree angle between them. And so if I measure the observable associated with this triple by coupling this system to another system in such, exactly like this, because here I have, I distinguish between two non-orthogonal states by coupling it to a system where I have three possible outcomes. So here the three possible outcomes will be this. If I get this outcome, then I know the state was this, because this state is orthogonal to this and could not possibly have projected onto this. If I get this outcome, I know the state was this. And that will happen with probability half, because the angle between this state and this line is 45 degrees. Halfway in this plane. So I will get this answer with probability 1/4, this answer with probability 1/4, in which case I know it's this, and this answer with probability half, because half the time this thing will fall into here, and half the time this will be projected into here. So, so these kinds of things come up all the time, where you have to distinguish between two non-orthogonal states. I mean, it's not usually put this way, but if you see exactly what's going on, then you see, oh, this is a way of distinguishing between two non-orthogonal states. Now, in Deutsch's original algorithm, as it was proposed, there is a probability half of failure. And if you look at what's going on, the probability half of failure is, well, when you're actually getting the result that's equivalent to an I don't know result. So, and it's really exactly this kind of thing. It does turn out that the two states are 60 degrees apart. You're actually making you have two registers, and the one register is corresponds to the M system over there, and the other register to the Q system. And when you're looking at the M register, you can get three possible values, and one of the values is just associated with not
not knowing what the outcome is.
So, so these generalized measurements play an important role, and I guess the way to think about it is that you're just looking at one system and inferring something about another system.
From what I saw, I only noticed that it's a construction where you compose the projected measurements and the claimed measurements. Do you always,
yes,
you're talking about generalized measurements as an abbreviation for that construction, or do you later use it as something on its own?
Well, I think that it's always like that. I mean, you can always think of it like that. I mean, it's presented in different ways.
So you're always staying within the summit.
Yes, I mean, well, yeah, in the following sense, that there is something that people in this field call the church of the larger Hilbert space. This is kind of a joke, but it says that any state can be purified. That's one part of it. It's the purification ritual of the Church of the Hilbert space. I actually forget what the other bits are now, but I mean the relevant bit is that any state can be purified. So any measurement that you think of as a POVM measurement or a generalized measurement applied to some system Q, and you can write down these operators E or M, which refer to the Q system, can always be re-expressed in a larger Hilbert space with respect to a purification of what you're doing when you consider the other system. And in fact, any POVM measurement always in fact involves some other system where there's some system in your laboratory which has pointers which are orthogonal. I mean, you could, the only way to do a POVM measurement is to actually in your laboratory ultimately have some system where the outputs of the system are associated with orthogonal quantum states, and it's that system which is interacting with some other system and being entangled with it and so on, and you're interpreting these outcomes as the measurement of some POVM observable or some generalized observable. I mean, in fact, as I see it, you don't really have to talk about generalized measurements at all. I mean, you can always talk in terms of entanglement with your ultimate measuring instrument, and then something that you can think of as a measurement is happening to the other system. But it's something like a measurement in the generalized sense of being able to identify which of two non-orthogonal states you actually have in front of you. You know, as opposed to a generalization in some other sense. Now, you can also think of these generalized measurements as measurements of fuzzy valued observables. This is another way of thinking about it. But I don't think that that's so relevant in the case of quantum information computation. It seems to me that always in that case, what you're doing is you're in effect distinguishing between non-orthogonal states. And for that, you need to enlarge the Hilbert space. And in the enlargement of the Hilbert space amounts to adding an ancilla system, as it's referred to, which is entangled with your actual system, and then making measurements on your actual system. And then if you want to use a language which refers only to your original system, then those operators that you define in that language will be Krauss operators, because they will satisfy the completeness condition, but they won't satisfy the orthogonality condition. Okay, well, I should stop there.
Similar thing.